welcome once again to Steve's Speed Shop. In association with our good friends at Douglas Loveridge Publications, the Enthusiast Bookshelf. This time on Speed Shop, we'll be getting all Edwardian on your ass and asking which was the greatest car before the Ford Model T. The three contenders are the also French Didion Bouton vis-a-vis the world's first mass-produced motor car, the Oldsmobile Curved Dash, and once again, there's a bit of a clue in the name of this one, the mighty Mercedes 60 horsepower. That's later in the show. And I'll be talking to Jay Rogers. He's the CEO of Local Motors over there in Arizona in the USA. It's a remarkable company with a unique philosophy about building cars. They make the Rally Fighter. It's got 430 brake horsepower. It's as fast and comfortable off-road as it is on-road. And you have to build it yourself. That's right, it's $100,000. You have to build the car. But first, a few weeks ago, I was in London for the RM auction. That really is a thing that you must try and get to if you are in London. It's one of the world's great car auctions. It takes place in Battersea Park. And it's motor auctioning as theatre. It really is an amazing and fascinating event. At lunch, I found myself sat next to a very interesting German gentleman, and he showed me some photographs on his phone of various interesting motor cars, none more interesting than the Rally Fighter. I hadn't heard of it. He's got two of them. The Rally Fighter is made by you, the customer, in the United States. It's an on-road, off-road car using a 6.2-litre GM V8 engine, 430 horsepower. But the thing about Local Motors is they are making cars in an entirely new way. There is a whole philosophy. It's not just car making. It's a new way of looking at the manufacture of all kinds of interesting stuff. And I really was fascinated to talk to the founder and CEO of Local Motors, Jay Rogers. Jay, I was going to ask you not what the Rally Fighter is. We'll come to that in just a second. But what the Rally Fighter is for. What do you think it's for?
Well, I mean, in a very grandiose or large way, the Rally Fighter is for independence. It was the first community-created vehicle. It was done in a year from a design on a sheet of paper to driving it around in the desert. And so in the broad scheme of things, it was the first maypole or liberating moonshot-motivated campaign for open-source cars. In its detailed specificity, it is a performance off-road capable vehicle with on-road chops. And it's a coupe with a high waist. It has 2 feet of wheel travel at each corner. And it is a solid axle, high torque, rear wheel drive, light front end, desert racing tricky. And yet it's quite dynamic on the highway. And so it runs a 6.2-liter General Motors LS series engine, and it boasts 430 horsepower to begin with, but the largest ones we've made are supercharged up to 720 horsepower. It weighs a little over 3,000 pounds, and it is a very capable high-speed desert racing off-road machine. That's what it is.
I'll tell you what I think it is. I was looking at... I was doing an interview with an author who's just written a book about Steve McQueen, and I was looking at some McQueen stuff just on YouTube, and I was looking at that scene from the Thomas Crown Affair where he's in that Mayer's Manx buggy with Faye Dunaway, and he's just hooning around in the dunes. But again, he would have driven the car there on the road, that Mayer's Manx. I actually met someone round the fire pit in the Parker Hotel in Palm Springs about a year ago, who actually owns that car. He owns the Mayer's Manx that's in the Thomas Crown Affair. And I just thought that's kind of the modern equivalent. A lot of people would look at your car, and I think the first question to them was, well, which category of motor racing is it eligible for? Does it actually fit neatly into any category? Could I take that car straight away and enter a championship or a race series?
You could take it and enter a Best in the Desert series. You could do some of the other series that are big, high-speed desert racing in the U.S. You could do a Nora series for sure right out. a score series, it would require another door bar, which is easy to put in. And, most of them, you'd want to take the windshield out. It's basically ready to go. It is, some race series get pretty snotty about having powder coating on your frame because they want to know if they can see cracks on the frame. Perhaps that's unfair to say snotty. They just want to have an exposed frame, but then you're going to be chasing rust all of your ownership life. And so you make your trade-offs for how easy or hard you want it to be to meet tech contingency. But basically the vehicle is ready to go. And certainly if you just want to go run the desert and, hoon around at high speed, you can leave your tongue hanging out of your, mouth because you're focusing so much on how fast you're coming up on huge obstacles. So it's ready to go. It's funny, the Baja boot, more if you're familiar with that one, another Steve McQueenism that's owned by Jim Glickenhaus now.
Hold on a second. I thought the Baja boot was James Garner's car, wasn't it? Wasn't Jim Garner the one who was really into the Baja stuff of all the Hollywood car guys? It was Rockford who was the Baja guy, wasn't it?
It might have been. I kind of thought that. We can check and look up a little bit.
I'm sure you're right, Jay. I'm sure you're right.
But I know that Jim Glickenhaus. I was there when he bought it at auction, and it's kind of a Myers Manx on steroids. Never actually did that well. It was Steve McQueen for sure. It was Steve McQueen, and it never actually did that well. But it was an awesome start to sort of high breakover angle, high angle of incidence, it's the beginning of the class one cars more than the trophy trucks. And fascinating to watch all these. Look, the designers, Bruce Myers and Stuart Reed, were the sort of progenitors of the Myers Manx. And you're right. They were an on-road, easy, interchangeable Volkswagen Bug, inside with a really, super cool, very specific use case. And I think the Rally Fighter might be the modern day equivalent of such a thing. It doesn't look like it.
Or was the idea always to get the buyers and the owners involved with the process of building the car?
So a great question, and it sort of opens up the whole world of local motors. So I'm glad you asked the question. Our company from the get-go was a community-based open source vehicle design company. We believe, like Linux, that complex systems are better handled by more minds than fewer. But we also believe that you have to stick a maypole out there and say, this is what we're going to make, or else you just get a smorgasbord of randomly assembled ideas. And so for me, the Rally Fighter was all that. It was a high-speed, desert-capable off-road machine with on-road chops. And it was going to have a look of a P51 Delta Mustang. It was going to be air conditioned, and it was going to be brutal. And you were going to be connected to it. And 500 people contributed to the design of that vehicle under the tutelage of our product development team. It's only natural that we would invite the owners to come and make it with us, because if you're a community-powered company, why wouldn't your customers be the most important members of that community? So for sure, the egg came before the chicken in that way. But I would say that it was not lost on us from the beginning that we wanted to prove that awesomeness could be made without federal motor vehicle safety standard type approval. And we've known for a long time, there are many people who know how to make a car. You don't need the federal government to give you a get out of jail free card to say that that car can be put on the road.
There are a couple of very interesting automotive companies here in the northwest of England. There were CCM Motorcycles from my hometown, just north of Manchester. They were leading the world in large capacity, single cylinder enduro bikes. They won major championships in the US against the likes of Honda, Kawasaki, Husaberg, the big sort of off-road guys. Because they were unique, they were the only guys building the very biggest of their kind. And there's also TVR cars. TVR built in the 70s and 80s, a glass fiber bodied VA engine up the front, drive to the rear wheels, no driver aids, bare bones, kick ass two-seater sports cars. I saw both of these companies move into areas that were occupied by the likes of Honda and Yamaha, in the case of CCM, and BMW and Porsche with TVR. They fell flat on their face. I mean, is the whole local motors things of remaining within niches? Please tell me that you're going to do that, because, you know, the second that you say that you're going to take on Detroit or Stuttgart, then or you're lost.
Well, you'll be welcome to say there's what you have said, saying the sooth in so many ways. If you want to know where we pray at the altar of, we pray at the altar of small volume, and there will never, ever, ever, ever be any different for local motors. Now, it's important that I say what that means, because we inherited this world that Henry Ford, Frederick Taylor, and Gottlieb Daimler left us, which is, if you're mass, you're meaningful for financiers, and if you are niche, you are a race car company, and you are not meaningful as an investment. In fact, you're likely to be famous because you're likely to build something awesome, and it's likely to fall into the history books as something that, you know, no longer made it. I think there's a third way, and it wasn't possible until there was an internet and a Federal Express and a DHL and open source legal protections for people's ideas. But the bottom line is, today, much like the Springfield repeating rifle that was created to interchange parts on the battlefield, we have digital instructions that if you stick to your knitting, you can make a vehicle the same way, low volume, everywhere in the world. And we have pioneered this notion of direct digital manufacturing, and we're taking it to its ultimate potential. Now, there's good news and bad news there. The good news is, I'll do the bad news first. The bad news is, it means that we're moving away from just steel and composite bodies, because there's a lot of handcraftedness that goes in there. And those are wonderful, but there's better ways to make. What we are doing is, we are moving toward direct digital manufacturing, where we are really letting the CAD files for chassis, body, components sing, and we're letting machines go to work to put them together. That doesn't mean that humans aren't involved in designing and running the machines and doing some assembly, but we're tipping the balance in terms of high precision, high mix, no tooling cost, low volume automotive. And when we're done, local motors will be able to do a new type of car every 4 months and put it in the hands of customers and get them to choose which low volume they want. What we will not do is make that car a million units over. So you have my promise that local motors is a low volume company forever, because what we believe is, we believe in customizability. We believe in technology in cars, and we believe in sustainability of design. We are pissed off that you could have 135 ignition switch failures that kill people, and that the first one didn't get recognized for what it was. We are pissed off that 11 million cars could get on the road with diesel emission trickery devices, and that it wasn't dealt with on the first car. And in an open source paradigm, people are empowered to get on your site and say, what's up? And we like that. I actually don't think, though, by the way, that Volkswagen, in the case of the emissions issue with diesel, is the only one to blame. I think that the regulatory bodies are just as much to blame, because they ask for the world with very little knowledge of what is possible. And so I think that a better education and rapid development in low volume is the future of automotive. And I think that we're going to see this notion being disabused, that somehow low volume is niche sports cars. It's niche awesomeness. It's niche technology, and it is the stuff which will put the first flying cars on the road. It will put the first truly autonomous vehicles on the road, and it will put the first amazing machines in every form of technology. So we're dedicated to that principle of revolutionizing automotive and getting out of the Gottlieb Daimler and Henry Ford and Frederick Taylor legacy, which was great for the last century, but now we need to do something different.
Do you know what, Jay? The industrial town north of Manchester, that's my hometown, is the twin town. We have a twin town system in Europe, where when you're a kid, you know, you go on a trip to your twin town. The other one is Angoulême in France, which is famous for motor racing. But with our twin town in Germany is Gottlieb Daimler's hometown, and there's a little display to him in the local authority gymnasium that I go to two or three times a week to try and stave off middle age. And I look at this. I look at this old painting of Daimler, and I wonder what he would think if we could bring him to the 21st century and lift the hood or bonnet, as we call it, of a car, and say, "Look, we're still using." I think he would be. I think he would be astonished and appalled that we were still using his engine in the 21st century.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think you are definitely right.
There's a new. There should be. You make me feel a very 20th century man talking to you, Jay. But I applaud. I applaud all of the things that you're doing, and I thank you for spending the time to talk to us today. It's been a revelation. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it also, Steve.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. Go 150 up the middle from the overall, he's pressed. Go 150 up the middle there now. You got a 3 right in over bump at the yellow wall. 40 to a turn 6 right open. 3 right in over bump, only 40 now to this turn 6 right open. Now go 200 out of it for me. Go 200 for me and go. Go 200 up the middle for me. 200 up the middle there now. You got a 2 left long. Then go 40 to a, don't jump into a fast 2 right. Go 150. Don't jump into a fast 2 right. Go 150. Don't jump it. Now it's fast. Now go 150 for me. 150 up. 4 right and a 2 left long passed out. 4 right into a 2 left long passed out.
That's the sound of Liam Brennan. He's a co-driver to a chap called Frank Kelly, who describes himself as the steering wheel supervisor. Frank races in the Mark II Escort Tarmac Rally Championship over there in Ireland. And he was brought to my attention by an amazing photograph. Frank's car, Baby Blue, so named because of its livery, a 1978 Ford Escort Mark II, is higher in the air in this photograph than any other car I've ever seen in any form of serious motorsport. And the Mark II Escort Championship in Ireland is super serious. In places, these cars, let's not forget Frank's car is 37 years old. These cars are faster than a WRC car. So I was very grateful to get an interview with Frank. He's a very entertaining guy. And first, I had to ask him about that jump. That jump, you didn't mean to do it, did you? Don't you sit there and tell me that you meant to do that jump. Tell us about that jump, Frank.
No sane person in their right mind would plan to do a jump like that, much as I would love to claim that title. No, that was a surprise to me and my co-driver on the day.
I bet it was more of a surprise to him.
yeah, it was actually his first rally with me.
Oh, you're joking.
Davy Vance has navigated for my brother for years, and he decided to take the plunge and have a go in Baby Blue. It was just a malfunction on my behalf on the recce. There was a slight kink coming to that jump, and I had concentrated very hard on getting that kink right. So when we clicked through it flat out in sixth gear, I thought, yes, I've got the kink right. And next thing, we're in the air at a crazy height thinking, oh, my God, this isn't going to go well. But
Frank, who's the guy in the second highest jumping rally in history, the Lancia, the 037? Is it Henry Toivonen?
Probably Henry Toivonen. There's a classic clip from him, I think, from Rally GB back in the 80s, and he had some crazy heights in that thing. And to be fair, back in those days, they didn't have the suspension that we had.
Frank, you were a bit higher than Henry Toivonen. How old's the car? The car's like 36 years old or something, isn't it?
My car is a 1977. Mark II's 1977.
Frank, probably it's nearly 40 years old.
Yeah, but probably the only original part is the wiper motor. The rest, pretty highly modified. Our Irish Escorts, we run as a modified car, and they are heavily modified. You know, we're running sequential gearboxes, 300-plus brake horsepower, remote canister suspension, big AP brakes. It's a pocket rocket. It's a rocket ship.
Well, I organised a classic bike race a couple of years ago, and I was looking at the lap times of things like Matchless G50s and Rob North Triumphs, and I said, hold on a minute, these middle-aged guys, no disrespect to middle-aged guys, some of my friends are middle-aged, best friends are middle-aged guys.
And obviously you're not.
Well, here's the point, Frank, and I will come to it. They were lapping faster than the professional riders half their age were lapping back in the day because of, as I'm sure you're aware, the improvements principally, not just in engine power, but in tyres mainly, and then suspension. Yeah,
I know. I have so much respect for Ari Vatanen and those guys back in the day in Mark IIs with basically not much better than a road tyre on it and leaf springs. I wouldn't drive to the shop on leaf springs because I'd probably go out over the hedge on the way to the shop on the road. So, you know, you see the things they do on YouTube clips and the times they were putting in those cars. And the safety things too, a bolt-in cage, a seat with no headrest on it. You know, just unbelievable when you look back on it.
Frank, I was watching the Manx Rally from 1982 earlier today. Yeah. And, I mean, I interviewed Ari for the first series of Speed Shop. And to me, he's one of the gods. He's never mind him rallying. He's in the top 10 racing drivers of all time from every single discipline. He's like a, he's almost like a shaman, like in an old Western movie, the way he talks about driving. He's a fascinating guy.
He very much, as like Colin McRae, he drove with his heart, not his head. You know, I think if he had drove with his head, he would have won many championships, as Colin McRae would have.
But,
he wouldn't, neither of the two would have left the indelible footprint that they have.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, Frank. I'm saying 1982. That car, the Mark II Escort then, the RS1800 that he was in, that's a 15-year-old car, and it's running right at the front. It's running right at the front on the Quattro with the guy that a lot of people think is the greatest of all time, Hannu Mikkola, is in the Quattro.
Yeah.
He can't get near the Escort, and the Escort's 15 years old.
Well, the Escort was always nimble and reliable. Whatever power it had, it could use all of it, and certainly back then the BDA that Ford had and the BDX were way ahead of their time engine-wise. They were a very basic car every other way with the live axle and McPherson struts in the front, but they did what they said on the tin. There was no hiding behind that. They did exactly what they said on the tin.
I've got two words for you as well. One's Bertie and the other one's Fisher. Was he so... He was, wasn't he? But here's the thing as well. Bertie Fisher's in the same... You can just look on YouTube, Manx Rally 1982, Jimmy McRae, of course, the great Jimmy McRae, father of... Alistair and Colin, of course. And the thing is, Jimmy gets overlooked because of his sons, and particularly because of Colin, but great driver in his own right, holding his own with the greatest that Scandinavia has produced. And you know, I think we'd all admit that Scandinavia's produced the greatest rally drivers.
Well, they're brought up on loose surfaces and they have a head start.
Tell us about your car. This was the second question I'm going to ask you, but typical talking to an Irishman, we've got 7 minutes in before I get to my second question. Although I don't do so bad myself on the butting in, I must admit. How the hell does your car hold together? Why doesn't it just, like, destroy itself?
Explode. Because it's an Escort. An Escort is heavily fabricated. We have all the logo lingo. It's tubbed. It's got different tub arches. It's got a spinal tunnel down through the inside, bigger for the bigger gearbox and the bigger prop shaft and the differential casings. It's all strong in the shell to begin with, and then we have a full homologated multi-point cage, all welded out to the strut tops, to the shock tops at the back. The hoop in the middle is FAA, the large FAA tubing, door bars, everything. It's all again, when you look back in the BDA, back in Ari Vatanen's days, the difference in the cage alone is massive. It's massive. I wouldn't want to go out in one of the old cages. You just wouldn't feel safe going rallying that anymore.
Your driving style.
Is that what you call it?
Do you know who you remind me of?
God knows.
A motorbike racer called Martin Finnegan.
Who
raced on the roads. You know Martin Finnegan. You know of Martin
Finnegan.
I've
heard the name.
He was a legend in railroads racing in Ireland. He was from the south, and most of the railroad racers that come out of Ireland on two wheels come from the north. The Dunlops, of course, the legendary dynasty. We had, of course, Robert, Joey. Now we have William and Michael. Yeah. But Martin was he was an ex-motocross champion, and he brought that kind of style to superbikes, and he was just so exciting to watch. And it's the same with you. Martin didn't always win, and I know you don't always win, Frank, but he was you and him are both incredibly watchable drivers. There's so much going on.
Yeah, it's probably similar, actually, because I was brought up on gravel. I started gravel racing at about 8 years of age. My dad raced in a local quarry events that we used to do, and I used to blag his car off him for junior races, even though I was underage. And I've just been brought up on gravel, and it's only in the last 4 or 5 years that I've ventured onto tarmac, and I haven't really changed my driving style.
We can tell, Frank.
I sort of use the gravel style. I get wrapped over the knuckles for it loads of times, but it's just the way it is. Old dog, new tricks. It's just the way I drive.
What is it with the Irish and this car, the Mark II Escort?
Small brains.
Yeah, but it's an everlasting love affair.
It is, and there's a whole industry built up around it now. A funny story, I was in Australia in 2008 on holiday, and I thought, this is my chance to trace down some immaculate Mark II body shells and get them exported back to Ireland. And the three places that I eventually tracked down, the cars were gone, and they gave me contact numbers in Ireland to get a shell. That's what happened to Australian Mark II Escorts that were back in Ireland. So there was an Irishman out there looking for cars, and he was being given contact numbers in Ireland.
So the Mark II Rally Championship is ongoing.
We have a few championships. We have within the tarmac championships. There's a Mark II specific championship, and then a two wheel drive championship. And inevitably, it's usually a Mark II that wins the two-wheel drive one, as well as obviously the Mark II one, because they're so well supported. If you take most of the tarmac, like the current championship, national championship, there would be typically 130 cars entered in every event, and I would hazard a guess that roughly half of those, 50 or 60 of those, would be Mark II Escorts.
Mm. Is it at the limit of its development, Frank? Is there anything that could make these cars go faster, or have they been developed?
We've been saying that ourselves for the last few years. Probably where it'll get limit is in regulation. I think they're starting to think about slowing us down. Certainly on the faster rallies, we're fit to outpace some of the WRC cars for top speed, especially the current 1.6 WRC car that are being rallied this year in the World
Championship. Let me just get this straight. You're racing a car from 1978, and there are points on a given course where your car is faster than the current WRC car in 2015.
Yeah. That is the thing. With my 2.5 Millington car, we're well over 300 brake horsepower, and we weigh about 1,000 kilos.
Wow! And that's with all the safety on board, proper.
Yeah, loaded up, ready to go, fueled, and all the bits and pieces. There are lighter ones, but I went for a wee bit of extra safety just to make I would trade off the weight for the safety. But in a certain rally, a nice dry day where we're not limited on traction, and it's a fast flowing rally where there's not a lot of junctions on it, we can keep up and sometimes get ahead of the WRCs.
Frank, there have been some strange interviews in the history of motorsport. My good friend, Anthony Reid, the touring driver turned historic racer, got punched live on television.
during
an interview. But even that interview isn't quite as strange as the one that I saw you give when you were in Trinidad. What were you boys doing in the Caribbean?
In my defence, I didn't know I was being interviewed.
But what were you doing there anyway, Frank?
We ended up... That's a long, long story. We haven't got enough time to talk that out. But the short version is the Trinidad and Tobago Motor Club got in touch with us, probably through our YouTube profile, and asked us would we be interested in taking Baby Blue out to do Rally Trinidad, which is a gravel two-day event. And after about a year of coercing, I finally agreed to do that, which was a big leap of faith for me, sending out my pension plan, effectively.
It's got to beat the hell out of being somewhere in Ireland that's incredibly wet and cold.
Yeah. The heat is a culture shock. I know at the end of the first day in 2014, my transmission has a metal gear knob, and I wasn't able to,
oh, wow,
to hold the gear knob for the last road section.
Not a problem.
The rally gloves for
not
the road section.
Not a problem if you're in the Ring of Cork or somewhere like that, but if you're in the Caribbean, it's...
I have literally got into my car in Park Fermi's here at home to do a rally, and you can't touch the gear knob because it's ice cold and you're afraid to stick into it.
Frank, can I ask you a personal question?
Yeah.
Do you struggle for co-drivers?
Yeah, I do. I do. But
oh, I can't think why.
And no, it's not the reason you're thinking of, I don't think. Rallying's expensive.
Yeah.
And I insist on that my co-driver pays the entry fee for a rally, which can be anything from 500 to 700 euro, maybe even more if it's a bigger rally. So I insist and they put in that investment because obviously I'm prepping the car, fuel, tires, all the bills that I have to put in. So for that reason, I do go through quite a few navigators because it's a big ask for a navigator week in, week out to pay that kind of money.
Frank, I can think of all kinds of motor racing that are incredibly lucrative in terms of the amount of sponsorship that they generate and money from paying customers or TV money or whatever. I can think of few forms of motor racing, though, that are as entertaining as that you take part in. But how do you guys get paid? How do you guys raise the money that you need to carry on competing and racing these incredible... the only thing I can think of that stayed at the very top of its game, as long as the Mark II Escort, is the XR750 Harley Davidson in flat track racing. Both have a career now that's looking at half a century at the very top of the game. But how do you guys keep going? Where do you get money?
Well, sponsors, purely sponsors. I'm a great man for trying to shake everybody down.
Good.
I've been very lucky this last few years with Bathshack.com approached us and became our title sponsor. And they've been with us now 3 years, and with Jefferson Tools lately. And a couple of guys that have been with me for 15, 16 years, Campbell Contracts, Charlie McHenry Motors. All these guys, luckily, you see, it's been a great thing. Social media in the last 4 or 5 years has exploded for the rally community here in Ireland especially, where it's opened up a whole new avenue of stuff that we didn't have before, where we're getting a bit of publicity where we couldn't get that before. I'm sure, as you know, being in the trade, effectively chasing after newspapers and media to try and get some publicity is very, very difficult. Also, I've produced my own media guru, my daughter, Lauren, who's 19.
Great.
She runs LK Media, and she does all the YouTube clips. She's studying for media at the moment. And she's been, and don't tell her, I hope she doesn't hear this, but she's made a massive difference for me getting all that out there, because that's, I wouldn't have the finances to pay to get that coverage. And she's been doing all that, as she says, just to get practice. She uses me as her guinea pig. So between that and a tight team, my brother does all the servicing for me and doesn't get paid. My wife does all the merchandise and doesn't get paid. I do all the driving and don't get paid. But there's nothing else I'd want to do. To hell with pensions and saving money. It's just everything is into rallying in our house.
Frank, somebody sent me a 20-second clip of you. Where was it? The jump Sperrins, was it?
Yeah, the Tour of the Sperrins rally up by Mahara.
And I thought, I have to talk to this guy. And I'm
Most
glad that I did.
Talk to me after that.
I'm glad that I did. It's been an absolute pleasure. And if people do want to support what you're doing, Frank, how do they get to you?
KellyMotorsport.net. That's our website, and they can get us through there. Our online merchandise is all on there, and our contact details are there.
I know, because I've been and I've seen, that it's a religion in Ireland, this thing.
Oh, it is. And it is very much so.
It is with you guys. And I tell you what, long may it continue, Matt.
Good man, thank you.
This is Fat Radio International. Embrace the alternative.
This is Steve's Speed Shop, a digital man cave for passionate petrol heads, where every week we try and find out which is the greatest motor car of them all. We've got a longish short list, really, of 99 cars. We pit three at a time against each other. This week, it's Edwardian Motors, the cars that came before the Ford Model T, which most of us think will be in with a shot right at the end when we do whittle it down to the top five. The Model T is probably bound to be there. So we thought this week we try and find out which was the greatest car before the Model T. I am fascinated by early cars. They seem to kind of wear their insides on the outside. You can see how a motor car works by looking at cars from this era. Everything's on display. I don't know too much about them, though, so as ever, I have a couple of experts with me to help me decide. But don't forget, it's not us that decide, it's you. So as soon as you've finished listening to the show, go to our Facebook page, Steve's Speed Shop, and votes for the greatest car before the Model T. Tonight, the three cars that we're... Sorry, very rude of me. Let me introduce my guests. They are the chairman of the Guild of Motoring Writers, Guy Loveridge.
Good evening, Steve.
And an expert on pre-First World War cars, pre-Great War cars, as we imagine we call it, being Brits. We do tend to call it the Great War. Jim Loveridge.
Hi there.
Hi, Jim. And the three cars that we're talking about are the Mercedes 60 horsepower Simplex, the Dion Bolton as a Lancastrian, my tendency
to say.
The Dion Bolton. Sorry, I do apologise. The Dion Bolton, particularly and specifically the Model D, the vis-a-vis voiturette, and the Oldsmobile Curved Dash, which was the greatest motor car prior to the Ford Model T. I think the Ford Model T guy was such a landmark car and will almost definitely be right there at the death when we do try to whittle it down to the greatest car of all time. So I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing to say, isn't it? What was the greatest car before the Model T? Because the Model T was such a leap forward.
Absolutely. The Model T is the benchmark in car production from pre-First World War years up into the 20s. It established the line. But before the Model T, everyone was doing it their own way. Everyone was going their own way. These three cars were in production at the same period. They started before and overlapped, but there's this one golden period, 04, 05, where they were all in production. The Curved Dash Oldsmobile, 18-inch Conrod, single cylinder, almost a flat single underneath your bottom.
Let's talk about that chap, Ransom Eli Olds, who was born in Geneva. No, not that one. The other one, the one that's in Ohio, back on June the 3rd, 1864. He claimed to have built the first steam car, his first steam car, as early as 1894, and his first gasoline-powered motor vehicle in 1896. He, it is said, is credited as being the inventor of the production line, not Henry Ford, as the mainstream media, lackadaisical slackers that they are, would have you believe. And that first mass-produced motor car was the car that we're talking about, wasn't it, Guy?
Absolutely.
The Curved Dash.
The Curved Dash. It's a very simple motor car. It doesn't have a chassis frame. It's two half-elliptic springs linking front and rear axles and a body sat on top at the median point. That is essentially what a Curved Dash Oldsmobile is for construction. So if you think about how you're going to push that thing through and drop a wooden body onto it, that becomes a production line as you push it along through a building.
Are you familiar with the story of how it came into production, Jim? The fire?
No.
Well, let me tell you guys the story. Apparently, the reason that the Curved Dash ended up being produced... Ransom Eli Olds was quite an operator, mm-hmm, I think the word might would be. Yeah. He was a man with an idea but no money, as so many of us are, and so he had to look for investment. He built 11 prototypes, but his factory, the Olds Motorworks, burnt to the ground, and the only one that they were able to save by pushing it out of the burning building was the Curved Dash. So with a bit of creative thinking, he didn't tell his investor about the fire and said, "We built 11 prototypes, and through extensive testing, we've discovered that this is the best one." Now, would you like to put your money down? But despite that, it's in its way, it's a little bit of genius, isn't it, Guy?
It is. It's a very, very simple design. If you put a Curved Dash in front of 99.9% of people and then put a horse in front of it, they'd see exactly why these things were called horseless carriages. It looks like a little buggy that you forgot to hitch your horse up to the front of. That's the Curved Dash looks like exactly what it was, a dashboard.
Particularly so because it doesn't even have a steering wheel. It has a tiller.
Yeah, it's a steer by stick.
Yeah.
Despite that, I mean, how... Jim, you'd be able to tell us. We're still in the era, aren't we, of everyone deciding where the controls are going to be, whether they're going to be operated by hand or by foot, how the vehicle is to be steered, braked, and generally sort of directed along the highway,
yeah,
if there was a highway, which generally there wasn't.
Particularly in America.
Where would something like a Curved Dash have been sold, Jim? Where would you have acquired one from? Would you have had to go to the factory to buy? Was the notion of the car dealership with us yet? I don't think it was it?
No. Some enterprising local businessmen would probably buy two or three, put them in their storefront, and so hope they sold them.
Like at a general store or a department store?
A hardware store, probably.
Perhaps something like a blacksmith's.
Yeah.
I believe in the States.
Well, of course, they were essential to the birth of the motor industry.
Of course.
The blacksmith was almost the midwife.
And in the... Yeah, I haven't really thought of it like that before. And in essence, would Olds have been making his motor car so that it was... It eschewed complexity so that the blacksmith could, if he had to, because presumably once it was dispatched from Lansing, Michigan, to its buyer, who could be, we're talking North America, who could be in San Francisco or upstate New York,
exactly,
at either ends of the country,
yeah,
it wasn't economical to send it back to the factory.
No.
And so it had to be attended to and maintained and mended. How robust? I mean, we tend to think of these early cars as being incredibly fragile. Would that be fair, Jim?
No. No, very solid. The engine was a great lump, even though it was a single cylinder. The gas tank was good solid tinware, and the water tank. I suppose the only complicated part was the carburettor.
I was going to say, are we up to a carburettor? Because I've been a pilot of various French monstrosities from very early motoring, from 10 years before this, very, very, very early stuff, Léon Bollée, de Dion, stuff like that. And I've been in things that didn't have a carburettor. I mean, there was some sort of weird evaporation system which seemed massively risky and dangerous.
The platinum tube and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He Who Lights the Fire, the chauffeur and all that carry on. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So a carburettor in comparison, I mean, apart from isn't it amazing how long the carburettor lasted on motor cars?
Yeah.
When do the first ones come in, guys?
Around this era, 1901, 1902.
So the curved dash would have had a carburettor.
It had a carburettor.
Yeah. What wouldn't it have had that we would expect to find on a car now? What about lights and stuff like that? And
acetylene, brass acetylene.
So it would have had lights. Yeah.
Yep.
Whether you would drive it in the dark, because that was almost to illuminate the existence of the car to other people.
Jim, I'm frightfully rude. Anyone who listens to the show on a regular basis would be able to say, but it's because I am very interested. This is the birth of motoring that us here and everyone listening is kind of moderately obsessed with, hopefully not to a pathological degree, but here are its origins. Here's where it all starts. And don't you feel, Jim, that at this point you could see it going off in all kinds of different directions?
Oh, yeah.
What if, rather than Henry Ford, Ransom Eli Olds would be kind of the number one guy in the first half a century of the American auto industry? How would things have been different, do you think?
That's difficult to say. Somebody else would have come along. I mean, you had the
Dodge Chevrolet, brothers,
Dodge
Chevrolet.
Brothers, Chevrolet brothers. And, of course, the French they regarded themselves as the leaders in the whole business, even though we all know the idea was dreamed up in Germany and dear old Gottlieb Daimler and what was the name of the other fella?
Fritz Benz.
That was the chap.
But they were beginning to sell cars into the States quite early in the last century.
Like Ford, old Ransom Eli Olds, he wasn't averse to a bit of self publicity. Okay. He knew the benefit of getting your fizzog in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, and on the television.
No. No,
not yet, Stephen. Hold your horses. Hold your horsepower. Your 2.5 horsepower, pal.
It might have been the silent movies.
Would we have been at that point yet? Hold on a sec. Let me just.
Yeah.
And there's a photograph of Ransom E. Olds racing on the sands at Daytona Beach from 1896 or 97. Nobody's quite sure. What a daring individual.
Absolutely.
It's kind of even that early. You look at that photograph and it's got everything that would make a young man want to take to motor racing. Adventure, excitement, and from the looks of it, a massive amount of danger.
But that was kind of where Ford had the edge, in that he got Barney Oldfield to do it all for him. He got proprietary daredevil.
Hold on a second.
Come and join in.
I thought Henry Ford did all of that himself. Have I been sold? Have I bought the story from that Henry Ford was? He was a genius at publicity.
He manipulated everything. I mean, Olds got the top vaudevillian of the day to record a comedy waltz, a tuppenny waltz called "In My Merry Oldsmobile."
Oh, marvellous!
That went to the top of the hit parade of 1904.
We're not going to sing it, though.
We're not going to sing it, no. But they were competing head-to-head. Olds' problem was that he didn't have the personality to keep the investors. Because he went from Oldsmobile to REO, Ransom Eli Olds, the Speedwagon thereof.
Of course, the REO Speedwagon.
And kept having to reinvent himself around the motor industry, whereas Henry Ford was bull-nosed enough to put his own name and reputation on the line and keep driving forwards. That's the difference in the pioneer years.
Today, it's hard to imagine that people wouldn't have seen the potential of the motor car. But in just the same way, you hear that Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs struggled terribly to get people to believe that people would actually want a computer in the house. Loads of people thought they were raving mad. Why would people want a computer in their house? And thus they struggled for investment in the early days of the Apple Corporation, now allegedly the world's most valuable company. It was the same for the early auto manufacturers, wasn't it?
That's now understandable, we can see, though.
Why wouldn't people want to invest in something that seemed so obviously, shall we say it, perhaps the most significant invention of the 19th century?
Staying with the States, the reason was there weren't any decent roads out outside the cities. And interestingly, in America, one of the growth areas was the electric car because it was used in town or in the city. So a lot of people...
And it was quieter.
Not smelly.
And it was cleaner. And it didn't set on fire much.
And, in Britain, of course, I think everybody knows, it was the horse business that kept it down. There was a huge amount of investment in horses. Virtually everything was drawn by a horse.
I saw a statistic the other day, which was how much horse muck had to be shifted from the streets of London every single day. And it was absolutely terrifying. Yeah. I mean, why anyone would want to have that problem, which, you know, why that business would have, anyone would have had a vested interest in carrying on that business, I have no idea. But I tell you what, let's get off the subject of, let's get off that rather unpleasant idea and thought and move back across the Atlantic. Not to these sceptred isles, not to Great Britain, but instead across La Manche, across the Channel, to France. And de Dion-Bouton, founded in 1891 after the Marquis Jules Albert de Dion saw a toy train in a shop window and asked the toy maker to make another. He was so pleased with what the guy did, he said, I tell you what, why don't we make a steam car?
Yeah.
Steam cars, Jim, do you think they ever posed a serious threat or competition? The electric car, yes, certainly, I think, in the early days. And surely to goodness now, with people like Tesla and then huge manufacturers like BMW producing incredibly fast and sexy-looking electric cars certainly. But were steam cars ever really going to take off?
Well, one of the things that delighted me was, I think it was the first auto club, the French auto club organised race, was won by a steam car. It was, in other words, it was the first vehicle home, but it wasn't allowed to take the prize because it was for internal combustion engine.
De Dion-Bouton Automobile Company was for a while the world's largest automobile manufacturer, known for their quality, reliability and durability. Let's talk specifically about the Model D. I think 1903, 1904, chaps.
Yep.
Yeah. And what was the layout of this motor, Jim? What would what would have been unusual about it?
A bizarre viz.
A vis-a-vis.
Wonderfully socialist, a social type of vehicle.
A socialist?
No, not socialist.
Well, like a Trabant or something like that. Or
sociable.
Skoda. Or sociable, not socialist.
Sociable. In that your passenger sat opposite you as the driver, and looking at you.
A 137cc. That's right, 137cc. One-cylinder engine with a trembler coil. Hey, ignition. A design speed, a top speed of 900 RPM. He increased the RPM with this car to 3,500, and it would usually run at 2,000 RPM whilst in use. It had a carburetor, both inlet and exhaust valves were overhead, and a flywheel was fitted to the end of each end of the crankshaft. So we're just seeing, aren't we, Jim, massive increases in the sophistication, reliability and usability of the car at this time, perhaps more so than at any other time in its history.
Oh, in a very short period, when you think that the first practical car, the Daimler's, I can't remember what it was called, but the three-wheeler thing, that was 1894, 5. And yet here we are, beginning of the 20th century, and we've got a very sophisticated little engine.
Absolutely. And the tyres. Do we mention the tyres? Michelin's pneumatic tyres. What would the roads have been like? Presumably, the road network in France would have been better developed than it was in the States.
It was, but it was all pavé. It was stone block. So they needed pneumatic tyres. Solid tyre devices shut themselves to pieces.
Yeah. This is a theory that I should probably expand in another place, but I'm going to throw it out here to you two because I think you probably both have an opinion. People criticise American cars for being kind of over-engineered and things being thicker and wider and stronger and heavier than they should be. Is this a legacy of their dirt roads, of their terrible road network, which was so demanding of their vehicles right from the very beginning?
Well, they say the Model T was pretty well over-engineered, didn't they?
Yep, and it lasted and was dependable.
The Model T Ford was the farmer's friend. I mean, a lot of them were little pickups, agricultural pickups, weren't they?
Listen to this. You both love this. What goes around comes around, guys. In 1901, the De Dion Bouton Motorette Company began manufacturing cars in Brooklyn, New York, and a small quantity were made with either two-seater vis-a-vis, the ones that we're talking about, the one where the driver and the passenger faced each other. The venture, though, was only in operation for 1 year as they gained a reputation for being unreliable in the American press.
Yeah.
And I wonder who put that reputation Absolutely. In the American press. Hey?
Yeah.
What? Nothing ever changes, really, does it?
Nope.
So,
Steve, if I can make one little book.
Of course.
The other thing is, De Dion Bouton made a lot of money and a lot of their reputation by the engines they made and supplied to lots of other manufacturers.
What was difficult about an engine at this time, Jim? Was it making power or was it making the thing hold together? Which was the trickiest?
Well, starting the damn thing was always a problem. I think it was making it hold together because metallurgy was in its infancy. I'm sure a lot of suck it and see was done to when you formed your crankcase and that sort of thing.
There was no such thing as R&D, was there? It was just
practical.
Make it, if it holds together, sell it to people, and then when they use it, you'll find out what's wrong with it.
That's right. Mm. Yeah. And De Dion Bouton seemed to get it right very quickly.
Doesn't the Italian auto industry still do that to a degree? Let's talk about an entirely different vehicle, the supercar of this period, the 60-horsepower Simplex Mercedes built for the Gordon Bennett Cup, was it, Jim?
Well, no. That's an interesting story, if I can digress a bit. It was basically a Grand Tourer. It was very expensive, very modern, had a honeycomb radiator, shaft drive, all those good things, modern things.
Because, of course, most cars would have been driven by a chain, yeah?
Chains or belts.
Yeah.
And that, of course, was one of the big issues of what are we going to do with our motor cars, chain or... And, of course, there are other silly things like disc drive, friction drive, belt drive. So the cars that were entered for the 1903 Gordon Bennett race, that was the one in Ireland, were the 90 horsepowers.
Right.
But a bit like poor old Mr. Olds, just before they had to get ready, there was a fire.
What is it with fires? Did they not realise that, like, gasoline and oil are incredibly... I suppose, guys... They were in wooden buildings. They were building these cars, these motor cars, in stables and barns in wooden buildings.
Precisely, that's right. Anyway, so the race team burnt out. So Mercedes asked, and remember, they're a German company, so there probably is quite a strong element of strong arming. Some of their richer customers, can we borrow your cars, please?
Wow.
And three were lent. And a little Belgian called Janazzi won the race in one.
In a stripped-down Grand Tourer.
It wasn't really a genuine race car.
Is this the origin, Guy, of that idea that carries right through the history of motor racing, which is take the big, luxurious Grand Tourer, take all the weight off it, and with that great big engine, it'll go like billy-o. It'll hold together.
Generation to generation, it holds true. There was just the other side of the Pennines from where we're sat talking now, there was a chap called E.R. Eddie Hall. He had one Bentley chassis, and in the roof of his motorhome, he had a body that he wasn't using. So he'd have his stripped two-seater racing body, drive it in, undo the 12 bolts, lift off the racing body, back out, drive into the other half of the motorhome, put the touring body on it and bolt it on. Yeah.
Listen to this, chaps. Cast iron inline four, two valves per cylinder, 9,293 cc's, a bore of 140 mil or 5.51 inches, a stroke of 51 millimetres or 2.01 inches, compression 4.5 to 1 and power 60 brake horsepower in 1903. Yeah. My God, it must have been like, can you imagine this thing passing you? It's 1903. You're trudging along some highway.
Three and a half horsepower to Dion or five horsepower Oldsmobile.
Or one of the early motorcycles.
And this comes through you.
On a penny farthing, and this thing comes by. A steel over press steel frame. What a machine. Drum brakes, of course. We're nowhere near disc brakes. We're way off disc brakes.
Miles off disc brakes. 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. And what sort of steering? What sort of steering would. Look at this, though. I'll just ask you that, Jim. But a four speed gearbox. A four-speed transmission in 1903. Did cars go back a bit from this, Jim? It seems to me that it's about 20, 25 years before cars that are the equal of this from maybe companies like Bugatti or American manufacturers like Duesenberg and maybe even British manufacturers like Vauxhall, it's another 20, 25 years before we see anything like this from anyone else.
Yeah, it was just refinement of existing. They'd reached a plateau. That was the best sort of car you could get with the right everything right from our point of view, and then it plateaued, and they just developed slowly, evolved slowly, and then you got the.
Gentlemen, can I ask you, and I must ask you, to call it 3-2-1 in traditional Miss World style. You're the third first moving up to the one that you consider to be the greatest car before the Model T. Jim, can I ask you first, which is the greatest of these three? Which one? 3-2-1.
The way the Mercedes. It, from an engineering and scientific point of view, it was the most advanced.
And between the curved dash and the Dion, which do you think?
The Dion second, and the dear old curved dash third. An ideal, lovely little car, fitted what was needed for the. It was cheap, it was practical, but it was a sort of a dead end.
Guy?
Mercedes in third place because they sold five of them.
Yeah. Oh, right. You love sales figures, don't you?
I love sales figures.
Don't blame me for it.
The Dion Bouton second, because we are looking at the vis-a-vis.
Yeah.
As an industrial entity fostering the early motor car, the Dion is streets ahead because they were willing to share their tech. Yeah. Mm. They saw it as a brave new world of cars. So, oh, Monsieur Renault, you want an engine? We've got an engine. Have that. But number one, the Oldsmobile, because it sold 19,000 units.
Wow.
And it gave the American wheels for the very first time. It wasn't the cheapest car out there, but there's more curved dash Oldsmobiles going to be taking to the streets of London to Brighton this November than any other single model. Mm. There'll be a lot of the Dion powered cars, but that's across eight manufacturers. The Oldsmobile, there'll be 30 odd of them.
Yeah. Well, I've driven the Dion and the curved dash Olds. I've not driven the Mercedes. In third place, I'm going to put the Dion. They're kind of like the people at the start of something, the Dion, who inspire the others by getting it wrong. It's the Dion's mistakes that spurs on everyone else to sort them out and create something better. The idea that you would steer with a tiller and that you would face each other in tandem style. The driver is behind the passenger who sat directly in front of them, facing towards them, thus obscuring their forward view. Only a Frenchman could think that was a good idea. In second place, I'll put the curved dash Olds. Again, I think that other people develop Ransom Eli Olds' great ideas. I think if he could have stuck to something and he'd had an investor who was willing to back his genius ideas, then he could have been Henry Ford instead of Henry Ford, but he wasn't. I've never driven the Mercedes. I didn't know too much about it until I started to do a bit of research here. It seems to me that it's a good quarter of a century, or at least two decades, before anybody really improves on what Mercedes were doing. It seems utterly remarkable to me that they were able to create such an incredible car in 1903, for goodness sake. And so for me, it's by far and away the winner here. But it's not up to us three. It's what you think. And please let us know what you think by going to our Facebook page, Steve Speed Shop, and voting for the greatest car before the Model T. That's it for another edition of Steve's Speed Shop in association with our very good friends at Douglas Loveridge Publications, the Enthusiasts Bookshelf. Back here next week on Fab Radio International, 7 o'clock UK time, for another edition of Speed Shop.